Welcome. Today is Tuesday, June 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the financial fallout in world markets continues following the UK Brexit vote. Turkey and Israel end 6 years of diplomatic strains. Michelle Obama pushes for girls' education in Liberia. Is racism on the rise in the U.S. and abroad?
These were no longer ideas that were whispered about in internet chat rooms. And suddenly, people came out of the woodwork. These ideas have been pushed into the mainstream in a way that we've never seen.
Millions also ahead celebrate gay pride in New York City. It's all on today's International Edition. Glad you could be here. Britain's crisis deepened on Monday as British and EU officials scrambled to deal with the shock of a voter's decision to leave the EU, plunging the country into what some describe as its worst disarray since World War II, as stock markets and the pound continued to decline and Standard & Poor's stripped the UK of its top credit rating. While hoping to head off further turbulence at the opening of the markets on Monday, British Finance Minister George Osborne made an early morning statement saying the British economy is fundamentally strong.
There will be an adjustment in the months ahead, but I think we are well placed to meet that adjustment. And our message to businesses, large and small, is very simple. Britain is open for business.
The U.S. stock market on Monday followed Europe and Asia in sinking further after markets around the world plunged on Friday. Well, as the fallout over Britain's decision continues, there are a number of questions about the future and how this will all play out. I'm joined by former ambassador, retired diplomat, and current president and CEO of the East-West Institute in New York, Cameron Munter. Thank you for joining us. This isn't just a question about the future of Britain, is it?
What people around the world are wondering is what the systemic impact will be. And I'll just take one area that I think is important. There's going to be a big set of questions that arise on security. The question will be whether Europe as a whole, which sees itself and its security as a unit, can it function? Can it continue to function in the way it has in the past in dealing with outside threats? And these outside threats can be anything from immigration to countering terrorism to the question of the future of its relation with Russia or elsewhere. So what will be the security impact of this choice by Britain to leave? No one knows. I think what we should look to is the upcoming NATO summit, which will take place in Warsaw in July, to see whether there is discussion about just what kind of reverberations will come from this, whether or not the assumption that we've had for many, many years that Europe as a whole works together in the transatlantic alliance, or whether somehow now Britain is separate or is committed in a separate way to security around the world. So it's a big question, one of many.
After the results, it looked as though there were Google searches after the fact on what it actually means. Is this an indication that there was some serious, I guess you could say, buyer's remorse? People didn't really know what they were voting for.
Well, no one really knows, of course, so this is speculation. But my sense from talking with people in Britain is that this is probably more a reflection of wishful thinking on the part of people who were pro-Europe and who lost. That is to say, I think there was a lot of belief among the people who were pro-Remain that the people who were pro-leave, the people who voted to leave, kind of didn't know what they were doing. I think this was part of the attitude many people had. And I think these stories, which is isolated stories about young people who said to the press, gee, I voted to leave, but if I'd really known this would happen, I wouldn't have done it. Or people who are looking on Google to see what does it mean to be in the EU now that the vote is over. My suspicion is that these are people grasping at straws. In fact, people chose to leave for more than just the question of, you know, we don't know what we're doing. Whether you like it or not, whether one does like the kind of the sense of xenophobia that came up in the anti-immigrant voting, well, that's what people chose to do. And there were people who were actually voting to leave who apparently weren't motivated just by the question of foreigners and taking one's country back. To be quite honest with you, I was pro-Remain. But my sense is that it is wrong to assume that there was simply a number of people who didn't know what they were doing who woke up the day afterwards and had regrets. I think it's much more serious than that.
Could Scotland block Brexit?
I don't think so. Britain has to sit down with the European Union and go through a process. It could be many, many months that would be the process of disengaging from the EU. And in that, in the course of that time, Scotland could vote again to secede, and many people who believed it was a close vote last time now believe that there would be renewed energy to depart so that Scotland, which is pro-EU, could stay in the Union. That, to me, wouldn't, I don't believe, would stop Brexit from happening. The only way I could see that there might be a mechanism by which the Brexit could be undone would be if, after Cameron's resignation, there were a general election, and the results of that general election were unambiguously pro-Remain.
As someone who admittedly was in favor of remaining, how concerned are you?
I'm very concerned. I think it's very important, not only for Britain, but for, let's take at least two other audiences, for the European Union, which has had as part of its mantra, as part of its plan, the idea of keeping the momentum towards the harmonization and the so-called ever closer union. This is a real blow. This is a real blow to the confidence of an organization that was having its problems to begin with, problems that were not just caused by immigrants. There was already pressure on the European Union, and this has given much more pressure on the European Union. The second is, you know, when you look at it from the United States' point of view, we, the United States, have always looked to the European Union as a partner, a strong partner in world affairs, and not just in kind of geopolitics, you know, dealing with Russia or dealing with the questions of the Middle East, but as a partner to deal with transnational threats like climate change, counterterrorism in the broadest sense. So with Europe being weakened by the loss of Britain, that makes that partnership that much weaker.
All right. Well, thank you for your perspective, Cameron Munter, President and CEO of the East-West Institute. Well, there have been a surge in hate crimes in the UK, which many fear is a result of Brexit. It's something British Prime Minister David Cameron noted in his first address to Parliament since the vote.
That we must be very clear about our commitment to tolerance, to diversity, and our complete intolerance of racism and hateful hate crimes that we've seen in recent days.
Well, joining me to talk more about it, Ryan Lenz with the Southern Poverty Law Center, a nonprofit organization that monitors hate groups. Ryan, just 2 days ago in Sacramento, California, the state capital of California, a white nationalist rally turned violent. Some analysts believe racism is on the rise in the U.S. and elsewhere. What do you say?
In the last 2 weeks, a young man walked into an LGBT bar in Orlando, Florida, and killed 49 people, including himself. A man who had known connections to a white supremacist U.S. group killed a British MP in the name of nationalism. And now we have a group protesting, a white nationalist group protesting in Sacramento, and the event turning violent for reasons that we don't quite yet know. So a group started by a man named Matthew Heimbach. Matthew Heimbach is something of a luminary and a rising star on the racist right in the United States. He started his racist activism as a student at Towson University. He led a white student union that very famously chalked the sidewalks with racist sayings like white pride and white guilt is over. So Heimbach graduates in 2013 and essentially enters the very vibrant racist underworld of this country, and he starts aligning himself with a number of hate groups that we monitor. He has basically touched or rubbed shoulders with the most prominent racists in this country, advocates for essentially white separatism, for whites to be separate from every other ethnic group in the United States. Furthermore, this ideology holds that America, the United States of America, is a traditional white homeland, a derivative of all manner of European customs and traditions. And therefore, the influx of caused by immigration of other ethnic groups is a threat to the character and composition of this nation.
It seems like there has been a sharp spike in racist incidents in the U.S. and abroad, and it all seems to be interconnected with what is happening in U.S. politics and what is happening in Britain.
Well, I think that there's a great parity between the political environments in the United States and across Europe. In the United States right now, thanks in large part to the nature and character of this particular election season, the ideas of nationalism are prevalent. The ideas of xenophobic approaches to immigration, as well as almost an isolationist approach to America's interests. Over the last several years, we've seen these populist political parties are growing increasingly prevalent and powerful. as we just saw in Britain, largely on grounds of immigration and the refugee crisis that has been growing and swelling across the continent. The same ideas are animating the racist and radical right in the United States. So enter someone like Matthew Heimbach, who advocates for a white nationalist or a nationalist populist approach to the future of America, and there's almost a direct mirror between the political positions in Europe and here. This election cycle has done more to animate and energize the racist right than any in my lifetime. Donald Trump enters the political race. He announces almost immediately his positions to build a wall with the U.S. border with Mexico, on the grounds that Mexicans are rapists and they're sending their rapists here. He follows that not too many months later with, very recently actually, with a position that we should ban all Muslim immigration to the United States. These ideas are ideas that have been sort of the pipe dreams of white nationalist racists in this country for decades. The idea of restricting immigration to the point that whites will once again be, you know, the prominent founders and inheritors of this nation's promise. Since Donald Trump advocated these positions, white nationalists and racists across this country suddenly felt that their positions, which have long existed, in this dark underbelly of American culture, all of a sudden had mainstream political support. These were no longer ideas that were whispered about in internet chat rooms. These were ideas that were existing on the national stage. And suddenly, people came out of the woodwork. These ideas have been thrown thoroughly or pushed into the mainstream in a way that we've never seen.
That's Ryan Lenz with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thanks so much. Well, the other big story in the United States Monday, two major rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court. It refused to loosen federal restrictions that prevent people with domestic assault convictions from owning guns. The ruling was a victory for gun control advocates who have increased their efforts following this month's mass shooting at a nightclub in Orlando, Florida. And the court also upheld abortion rights on Monday. Let's talk about it with our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee. Hi, G. So all of this, not surprisingly, has been trending pretty heavily online today.
That's right. People have been talking about the Supreme Court's ruling since Monday morning, and the trending hashtag is hashtag SCOTUS, short for the Supreme Court of the United States. The court decided to overturn a Texas law that placed restrictions on clinics that provide abortion. The 2013 law reduced the number of abortion clinics in the state, making some women in Texas to fly to another state altogether to get the procedure done.
So who exactly has been tweeting about it?
Feminists, pro-life activists, and even a Supreme Court justice. I personally learned about the breaking news from Justice Don Willett on Twitter. His handle is @JusticeWillett. He sent out this tweet. Breaking. Hashtag SCOTUS rules 5-3 that Texas omnibus abortion law is unconstitutional.
Well, there certainly is a big divide in the country surrounding abortion rights. Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that it's trending at all on social media.
That's right. It has so many facets to it, from religious aspects to women's rights. A woman named Terry tweeted, "Who cares if Donald Trump or some men in Congress are pro-life? When are they going to get it? They don't own our bodies." A man named Leo, on the other hand, tweeted this, "Not surprised, liberals are okay with killing 3,000 babies a day, but want to take away our Second Amendment rights."
So he linked it to gun ownership and the right to bear arms.
Hmm. That's right.
Interesting.
Yeah, the gun control issue actually was brought up pretty frequently. To CNN Politics Facebook post about the SCOTUS decision, the most liked comment also mentioned it. A man named Darren left this comment. "Imagine if we regulated guns in the same manner as we do abortions. One gun shop per state, note from your doctor prior to getting a gun and physical probe." More than 700 people liked that reply within 5 hours. Lori, that's all from me today.
All right. Thanks so much, G. And you can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the other stories we're following at voanews.com. An orphanage in Iraqi city is housing kids who lost their parents to attacks by Islamic State. Cleveland and Philadelphia enhance their security for the upcoming political conventions. Students protest Facebook cheating scandal in Egypt. Nigerians are split over negotiating with oil militants, and NASA's Juno air spacecraft is nearing Jupiter to shed light on the gassy giant. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our website or in our mobile app, VOA. This is International Edition. Well, the Israeli and Turkish prime ministers have announced the restoration of full diplomatic relations, which have been frozen for 6 years following the killing of Turkish activists seeking to break Israel's economic blockade of Gaza. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish Prime Minister Binali Yildirim announced the countries will restore their ambassadors as soon as possible. The re-establishment of full diplomatic relations follows more than a year of secret negotiations. Relations collapsed when Israeli commandos killed 10 Turkish activists who tried to sail to Gaza, which was under naval blockade in 2010. Under the deal, Yildirim said Israel will pay families of the dead activists $20 million in compensation. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, speaking simultaneously in Rome, said the naval blockade of Gaza would continue, saying it's vital to preventing arms delivery. Ankara has been demanding Israel lift the embargo in return for full diplomatic relations. Yildirim said under the agreement, Turkey would be allowed to deliver aid to Gaza through Israel.
Cuma günü ilk gemimiz İsrail'in Ashdod limanına.
He said the first ship loaded with more than 10,000 tons of humanitarian aid will leave for the Israeli port of Ashdod on Friday. Yildirim said under the agreement, Israel's blockade would be effectively ended under Turkish leadership. He also said Turkey would build a 200-bed hospital in Gaza. Istanbul-based political consultant Attila Yeşilada of Global Source Partners says powerful forces of mutual interest are driving the deal.
There are political reasons as well as economic reasons. Obviously, the dynamics of the Syrian war has compelled both Israel and Turkey for a reconciliation. Israel was afraid that its border with Syria would be occupied by radical fundamentalist organizations.
Israel and Turkey were once allies whose relationship extended to close military ties. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry welcomed the move. Washington has been lobbying hard for a rapprochement between two of its most important allies in the region. Political scientist Cengiz Aktar of Istanbul's Süleyman Şah University says little more than pragmatism supports the relationship.
This is the sheer and cold interests of states, and no more. Turkey remain deeply anti-Semitic country, and probably Israel remain a deeply anti-Muslim country.
Observers point out that despite recent tensions, bilateral trade has continued to grow. Netanyahu said the deal will have an immense impact economically for Israel. Observers point out the deal with Israel is also part of a wider strategy of repairing relations with neighbors and former allies, which has seen Ankara become increasingly isolated in the region. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, some great new movies to hit the theaters. We've got a preview for you. But first, at this year's March in New York, marking the end of Pride Week, a record-breaking crowd of LGBT activists and allies marched down Manhattan's Fifth Avenue on Sunday in what will long be remembered as a powerful display of solidarity and remembrance for the 49 victims killed 2 weeks ago in an Orlando gay nightclub.
New York City has never been more proud.
It's a celebration for everybody who cannot express themselves every day. Today is a day.
It's not just about, you know, LGBT. It's about everyone.
It's nice to have a place where you can come and, like, be yourself and just see everyone else who is also very true to themselves.
Between cheering and dancing amid ramped-up security, the 46th annual LGBT Pride March of New York, which featured a record-breaking 32,000 marchers, took on extra significance. Parade-goers and participants mourned and remembered the 49 mass shooting victims 2 weeks ago at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando.
How many more have to die? How many more have to die?
Nick Shamp, who traveled from Connecticut with his boyfriend, said he cried at the sight of tributes dedicated to Orlando victims.
And a person saw me and they were like, "You're being too serious." And I'm just like, "Well, that happened." And it's hard. And they're like, "Well, you need to stay proud and you need to stay strong." So now it's just an overwhelming positivity.
Positivity and acceptance, which extended in the days after the shooting to the family of Corey Ligon, an LGBT member of the U.S. Army.
It actually brought me closer to the people that support me for my lifestyle choices. Me and my family have gotten much, much closer. They're more accepting now.
The struggle continues for LGBT communities worldwide to gain equal rights and live free from fear of persecution and discrimination. For many of them, from both near and far, Sunday's parade across an entire New York City borough served as a beacon of hope and a message of enduring love. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
Well, turning to the latest movies now in U.S. theaters, the Disney Pixar animated film Finding Dory topped the weekend North American box office for a second straight week. But there are also some good new movies to consider. Joining me now, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, I know you saw the new flick starring my boyfriend, Matthew McConaughey.
You and about 10 million other women around the country, around the world.
I know.
He stars in this historical drama called The Sweet State of Jones. And this is a history lesson that's really not taught in schools about how during the Civil War, a man named Newton Knight defected from the Confederate Army and went back to the Union. But he took a small piece of Mississippi and declared it a free state. And he, and along with some other deserters from the Confederate Army and slaves, took over this eastern part of Mississippi and said, "Look, you know, we are fed up with what the Confederacy is doing. They're stealing our farms and burning down our homes, and we are going back to the Union." So it was just, he took over this little piece of Mississippi. So and he was also very progressive because he was in a relationship with one of the slaves and had children with her. And also in the 1950s, if you fast forward 100 years later, you know, there was a Mississippi trial going on about one of his kin being of mixed blood, and he couldn't marry, you know, because of what happened 100 years ago. So this is a real interesting history lesson, and also the Civil War. It's very brutal. The opening sequence really reminds you of Saving Private Ryan, just to remind you how brutal the Civil War was.
Mm.
McConaughey gives incredible performances, but if you're a history buff like I am, this was a winner. It really was.
Another movie that you saw would probably be a lot of people's worst nightmare, The Shallows. Sharks.
Oh, absolutely. He has a big great white shark. Blake Lively plays a surfer who goes back to this hidden beach near Tijuana, Mexico, to pay tribute to her mom who died of cancer. She was pregnant when she surfed there, you know, 25 years earlier. And she just so happens to start surfing where there's a site has staked out its feeding grounds. So she ends up being stranded in this little tiny rock during low tide, trying to figure out how to get back to shore, which is only 200 yards away, as this great white keeps circling around her.
Mm.
So it's a thriller. It's a story of survival. It's really interesting how they shot it. And this is the 41st anniversary of Jaws. It was released 41 years ago on this week. So is that a coincidence? I don't know. So if you know this thing about sharks, you might want to just look through your fingers like I did.
Yeah, that sounds a little scary. May never want to get back in the water again.
Exactly. And, you know, the special effects have come a long way. So if you like a good thriller, then yes, definitely check out The Shallows.
And we've got one for our Independence Day holiday coming up.
Absolutely. 20 years in the making. We have the sequel to Independence Day, which was a huge hit back in the summer of 96. Well, it's 20 years later, and the aliens have come back with a bigger ship, with bigger weapons, with bigger aliens. And we have the original cast back, except Will Smith, who declined to be in it. But we have Jeff Goldblum, and we have Bill Pullman back as the president. And this time, it's pretty much the same thing as the first movie was 20 years ago. It's really disappointing that the director didn't give us a ground war or do something different. It's almost just a carbon copy of the original. And it was really disappointing in terms of the dialogue, the story, and the same actors. It just was deja vu all over again. It was a big, big disappointment. I suggest don't see it. Go see either The Shallows or Free State of Jones.
All right, Jeffrey K. Howard, full reviews and videos, VegasFilmCritic.com. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. And, of course, you can find us anytime online. You can also follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Follow me at Lori London. Thanks so much for being here. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Central America's Northern Triangle countries are taking important steps in their long effort to rein in corruption and criminal enterprise and to establish the rule of law. Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, the countries of the Northern Triangle, have for decades been plagued by high levels of violence, transnational crime, criminal gang activity, and corruption. As a result, the three countries have suffered years of social and economic stagnation, lack of economic opportunity for vast segments of society, and deep-seated issues of social and economic inequity. And one of the greatest obstacles standing in the way of effective reform has always been impunity that allows criminals to continue operating beyond the reach of justice. Working in partnership with the governments of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, the United States is investing in the U.S. strategy for engagement in Central America, which seeks to improve prosperity, security, and governance across the Northern Triangle. The U.S. is employing a three-pronged approach to reach the security goals, said Assistant Secretary of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs William Brownfield. First, we support local programs that impact people who live in affected communities. Second, we help to reform institutions, offer training and capacity building to create better performing law enforcement, criminal prosecution, courts, and corrections. And finally, we boost those organizations that provide law enforcement management, control, and protection of ports and borders on a daily basis. And we've seen some excellent results over the past 12 months, said Assistant Secretary Brownfield. In Guatemala, a wide range of government officials, including the president and vice president, have been removed and arrested on allegations of corruption, thanks to a long investigation by the UN International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, commonly known by its Spanish acronym, CSIC. In Honduras, a civil society-led commission is reviewing members of the national police and has terminated a significant percentage of the highest-ranking officers it has reviewed to date. More positively, over 50 new model police precincts in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador will serve as a core for a community-based security strategy. Additionally, some 60,000 youths from all three countries have undergone a gang resistance education and training program to help them resist recruitment by gangs. The governments of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras have embarked on a path of transformation that will improve their people's economic opportunity, governance, and public safety. The United States is proud to aid them in their efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.